Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Journey to Success Radio Network. Our purpose on Journey to Success Radio is to interview and promote people who are making a positive difference in this world. My name is Tom Tutall Cunningham. I'm a Napoleon Hill Foundation certified instructor, helping people to live positively with and through the many and varied challenges that life throws at us. I've had rheumatoid arthritis from my jaw to my toes since the age of 5. At age 50, 45 years later, I've had 4 hips, 4 knees, and 2 shoulders replaced, which makes me sound like a spider, and I've been hospitalized about 40 times. I also stand about 5'1", and that's due to the steroid prednisone that I took to fight my arthritis. And despite those challenges, anyone who knows me knows I always answer amazing when asked how I'm doing. I tell people 80% of the time it's true. The other 20% of the time it's to remind myself that it's true. Find out more about me at my website, tom2talll.com. My guest today is the amazing Frank O'Day. I've been fascinated by him for a few years, and so it's exciting for me. As a young man, Frank O'Day was a homeless person living on the streets, panhandling for nickels and dimes. Today, he's a celebrated business person, best known as the founder of the Second Cup with 350 stores, I believe at this point, or even more. He was also involved in founding a number of other successful international businesses and not-for-profits. One was ProShed Security, and I remember that company and how well they did, and they were on the forefront of business. War Child Canada, Street Kids International, and the Canadian Landmine Foundation. He's been appointed an officer of the Order of Canada, and 2 Canadian universities have awarded him honorary degrees. It's an inspiring story of resilience and triumph in the face of adversity, which is also recounted in his book, When All You Have Is Hope. He is also the author of Do the Next Right Thing, Surviving Life's Crises. Mr. O'Day's most recent projects include developing sustainably affordable housing in Brazil. Welcome to the show, Frank.
I am more than delighted to be here, Tom. I can't tell you how much I admire the work that you've done in your history. So it is perhaps a mutual admiration, but I do think that you're doing such really good work. And I'm delighted to be part of it, so thank you. It's an honor for me.
Thank you so much, Frank. And our mutual friend, Phil R. Taylor, featured you on the Napoleon Hill Foundation, Nightingale Conan, 17 Principles of Success audio program. And I was so inspired when I heard, as soon as I got to the office, within about 3 minutes, I had emailed you because I figured I got to talk to this guy. So from homeless... And I looked up because I read this before. There's been a lot of famous people who've been homeless. Jim Carrey, another Canadian, yep. He was homeless for a while. Personal finance guru, a lot of Americans will know her, Susie Orman. She's now worth many millions of dollars. She was homeless for a while. Halle Berry. I heard from the CD your parents at some point just eventually kicked you out. Was it alcoholism that drove you to be onto the streets?
Yeah, actually it was. Just to be brutally frank, I was sexually abused as a young man, and my relief from pain came from alcohol. I began drinking very early, around 13 years of age. By the time I was 15 and 16 or so, I told my parents about the abuse. They didn't, in those days, couldn't cope with it, didn't know what to do with it, and my alcoholism just increased, and by the time I was 21, my dad sat me down in the den of our home and said, Frank, for the good of the family, you have to go. You're destroying the family, and that your mother's tired of clearing up your best balance checks on Westminster Avenue. Your brothers and sister don't want to bring their friends home anymore. They don't know what shape you're going to be, and I'm tired of the wrecked cars. I wrecked 17 of his automobiles. So he was tired of the wrecked cars, the police, the courts, the lawyers. I was destroying the family, and he was right. And he said, look, you've got to go, and frankly, I don't want you to be in touch with any member of the family until you've fixed your problem. Whatever your problem is, you need to go and fix it, and don't be in touch with anybody until you do, But he said, I did one thing for you. I got you a job. He had a colleague in the paint business who needed a salesperson in Ontario and southwestern Ontario. So he said, you got that job. You start tomorrow. Goodbye and God bless. That was, in retrospect, is a great favor, because when I got to Toronto or Oakville and I began to make calls, I got the orders, paint was shipped, all the things that you'd expect from a young man at a first job. But after a while, I began to drink, and of course, the outcome of that was to lose the job, and then the next job, and the next job, and the next job, and the apartment became a basement apartment, a flop house, and finally, just a three guys to a room, and in a tiny little flop house on Jarvis Street. And along the way, I'd lost everything I owned. I just had everything that I owned was on my back, and 50 cents a night, and three guys to a room. And the rule was you tied your shoelaces around your ankle; otherwise, the first guy up got the best pair of shoes. It was a pretty dirty, lonely, and sometimes violent existence. So that was my journey to the street. Alcoholism took me there, and frankly, alcoholism has been a great gift. I didn't know that at the time, of course, and it didn't look like that. Oftentimes, gifts, as you know, are not what they look like, but inside that box of alcoholism, once I fixed my problem, it became a great gift. And I have recovered from that and been able to go on.
Wow, and this is one of Napoleon Hill's and my favorite principle, learning from adversity and defeat, and every failure, defeat, there's some seed. But when you're in the middle of it, you're not seeing many seeds. But oftentimes later in life, you can take what you learned going through those tough times, and you can have empathy with others and also let them know that change your thoughts, change your actions, it's possible, encourage them, right? And so you got to that.
In fact, I'd just like to just follow up on that, Tom, if you don't mind. I was at a meeting just 4 or 5 days ago. It was a little private meeting, and there were only three of us in this little around a table, and we were talking about our history, and I didn't know one of the people at this table, and this gentleman was sitting at the end of the table. He'd be, 70-ish, not very well, overweight, walking with a cane, had a hip replacement. The other fellow that was at the table was a physician. I did know, and we were chatting, and I talked about being abused as a kid. And about 3 minutes later, this older gentleman looked at me, and he just frowned and then smiled, and he said, and he told me the story of his abuse, and he said, I have never told that to anyone. He'd been carrying that secret and that pain for 60 years, roughly.
Wow.
So to be able to share without shame, just tell the story, that gentleman was able to relieve himself of a burden he'd been carrying for 60 years.
Wow.
Amazing.
And I have seen that so often in life, Frank. I remember a men's group Bible study it was. And it was like about a dozen guys, and most of them were presidents, owners, that kind of thing. And when one guy would talk about something that he thought was bad, his thinking or whatever, and it was so amazing that someone else would say, oh, my God, okay, so you have had that happen to you too, or you thought that as well. And when we kind of call it take a mask off, just open yourself up and share. You never know who's in a room that's going to be like...
Absolutely not, and you have no idea what's going to... I'm sorry, go on and on. I want to go back to the first day I sobered up. The reason I sobered up, I was standing in the park at Shooter and Jarvis Street in Toronto, Ontario, waiting for the other two guys to come out and panhandle like we did every other day, 99 cents, bottle of wine. Get out there, get 99 cents, get a bottle of wine, go and sit beside the flop house, drink the wine, tell ourselves lies, and go back and do another bottle. And over and over and over until the night we had to make the most, at night we had to make the most important decision, and that was we'd get 50 cents each to sleep indoors or we sleep on a park bench.
Oh.
One day I woke up on December 23rd, 1971, stood in the park waiting for those guys to come out and decided at that point I'd had enough. And I don't mean I couldn't drink anymore or fight anymore or drug anymore or get arrested anymore. What I do mean is I couldn't trade off I could no longer trade off the values I had learned as a kid. Every value I learned, it seemed to me I'd trade off. It seemed like I traded off my soul. It seemed to me that I either had to die or change. die or change. Suicide was a constant thought at that point, hopeless and hopeless almost. And a commercial came back that I'd heard on the radio that said, I don't know what the commercial said, but the tagline said, if you're having problems with drinking, call us. We're in the book. Call us, we're in the book. That came back to me. I went, I panhandled, I stood on the corner of King and Jung, waiting for hundreds of people going by. Finally, one guy walks by, puts a dime in my hand, and walks out of my life. Into my life, a dime, out of my life. Don't know who he was, never will know, but on that dime, my life completely changed. He has no idea, back to your point, you never have any idea. That man had no idea the impact of his dime. I encourage people always to give, to give from their heart, because you have absolutely no idea what the outcome will be.
Ah, oh, wow. Exactly. Give of your time, your energy, and your money. And someone says, oh, I only have like a loonie. Give it. That's enough. Ten cents change your life. My goodness.
It changed my entire life. On that dime, I got sober. For the first 6 months, I was completely unemployable. Then I got a little job, and then I got a little better job, and before long, I'd founded the second cup, and then I sold that. I started a portion. I sold that. I've done all these not-for-profit organizations, and I'm now starting two new companies. I'm 68 years old, and I love it. And all of that because that man gave me a dime.
Wow. And one thing I love that you share, actually, today, if you probably know this, but January 28th, Bell Canada now, I think a couple of years in a row, they're celebrating mental health. And so, hey, with chronic pain since I'm 5 years old, I thought of suicide numerous times. When you're in excruciating head-to-toe pain and it endures for a while, you're making all kinds of things go up in your head. And so people should not be afraid to admit that. And if they are thinking that and they are thinking of it, talk to someone.
Yep.
Just open up about it. Other people have thought this, but... if you just share and open up, someone will say, wow, I almost killed myself too, but this is what I did and this is what I thought and look at where I am. And so, you know, be open to share if you do have those thoughts.
To your earlier point, our history is a great gift.
We
just need to recognize it and stop being ashamed of it. It is a gift, and you have no idea what value that gift has until you give it to someone else.
And so you go from homeless, you decide to change because, wow, isn't it nice to be, when people say, oh, Tom, why do you say amazing? I say, well, listen, I was brought up in an amazing family, taught great values, good people, taught politeness, honesty, all hard work, show up early, all the great things. And so it's nice that you were able to think and say, I was brought up different than this. And so, but one phone call, but now you still live on the street and... but your thinking starts to change? Did you meet different people who helped you or find some books that helped you? How did it consistently move from that thought and that phone call to every day making a bit of change, die or change, as you said?
Yeah, die or change. Well, I made the phone call, and the phone call was to a 12-step group because this is a public broadcast. I can't say what the name of it was because it's an anonymous group, but I suspect people will figure that out. I made a phone call. I joined with a group of folks who had the same problem. And for the first 6 months, I was completely unemployable. I was living on the street, the Salvation Army, the Fred Victor Mission. My first Christmas was 2 days after I sobered up at the Fred Victor Mission with, you know, 100 other people lined up having their turkey and all by yourself, you know, that loneliness in the crowd. And I'll never forget, you know, I went to my first meeting and the fella after the meeting took me for coffee and he told me what was going on and he handed me a handful of dimes as we parted and he said, now listen, Frank, here's a handful of dimes. Your choice is to either use these dimes to call me, in those days a phone call was a dime, call me, or you can use these dimes and there's enough here to buy a bottle of wine. It's your choice. So the next morning I had to make the choice. Would I phone or would I buy a bottle of wine? And thank God I phoned. But, you know, I never forget that night I went to bed, the very first night after that first meeting with those dimes in my pocket, and I lay on these dirty sheets with three guys to a room, and it was a horrible mess. But I was filled with the very most important emotion that I can think of, and that is hope. I had hope that perhaps, just perhaps I could stay sober. And with all, and it has always been my view that if you don't have hope, then you can't have any vision for yourself. And if you don't have a vision, then your dreams die. But vision without action is simply that, a dream. So I need hope, vision, action. And my drive was to have continue the hope even when it was seemed hopeless,
right.
Have a vision of being sober, and take the action, which was use the dime, call my buddy, make sure that I got to a meeting that night. And I did that over and over and over and over again. And before long, I was a week sober, a month sober, 2 months sober, 6 months sober. And it was it isn't a miracle, but it is. It isn't an instant cure, but it is a cure. You just need to have hope. Hope first, take the action, and the vision will follow.
I love it. And that starts with all you need is a glimmer of hope. And sometimes our stories are the glimmer of hope, where people say, well, if that Frank O'Day can do it, he doesn't seem like such a sharp guy. Look, you know, he was homeless. Anything that can help someone to think that, hey, other people have gone through this. I can do it. And I have someone I can call. I can have someone who can mentor me.
Absolutely.
And so that's so important. Now, and then vision. As you said, Napoleon Hill's number one principle is definiteness of purpose, which is a lot about vision. It's about being who you know you can be, the talents, skills you were given, the way you were brought up, and definiteness of purpose. Because if you didn't have that on the street, you had the easiest thing to do is just use those dimes in the wrong way.
Absolutely. And you know, the thing that I have discovered, as Emmett Fox has often said in his writings, along with Napoleon Hill, but it all starts with our thinking, doesn't it?
Yes.
If we think incorrectly and make the wrong decisions, then the outcomes are bound to be wrong. It all begins with how I think. And the only thing I control today is how I think. And I can make choices, and then once I make the right choices, do the next right thing, the results will automatically come out.
Yes, I love that phrase, do the next right thing. What do I do now? Whatever the next right thing
is. What do I do now?
Is.
And, you know, people say, gee, I don't know. Instinctively, I think you do know. If you get out of your own way and you have choices, you know. And as my great sponsor always said, if you don't, choose the hardest. That's usually the right thing.
Do what other people aren't doing.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, wow, what a turnaround. So, but let's talk about business now, because, well, even hard to go from, okay, now you're homeless, you're changing your thoughts, you got the sponsor, you're using your dimes properly. That must take some time. How was it long between when you made this decision with this dime to make this phone call to where you're employable, business person, who you are today kind of thing?
Well, after 6 months, they took me up to the X-Talker. They said, your synapses are starting to work again, and you're starting to make some sense. So they took me up to a place that sells used clothing, and they bought me a suit. And it was, you know, green pants, a green plaid jacket, a green tie. I haven't worn green since. But in any event, they sent me out to get a job. Now, there's a challenge when you don't have an address and there are no cell phones and you need to go and get a job. That's pretty tricky, and the top of your CV is panhandling. Not a lot of people looking for that. You know,
who bought you the suit?
The guys from my group, they took me up there and they bought me a suit and they got me going and they sent me out to get a job. And they said, now listen, you go and get a job. Now get a sales job and a job that pays, but that's what your talent is. So I went out and I got a sales job. Now it wasn't easy. I had to knock on a lot of doors, and a lot of people said no, and I had to impress the guy on the first call because there was no way he could call me back. I had to call him back because I didn't have a phone. But I finally got somebody took a chance, you know, and I got a job. It wasn't much of a job; it was a little job, but I knew if I got one, then I would have a CV. I could get another one, so I was just determined to take whatever I could get, so I could get back in the game, as it were.
Yeah.
And I did, and then I got a little better job, and by 1974, now I sobered up in 71, so 3 years later, I'm now living back in Oakville selling construction equipment, and so now things are sort of turned around a little bit, and life had lots of hope and lots of vision.
Nice, and so you, from going from a salesperson, how do you What made you think? Because I would, if I'd been from homeless to working construction, sales, you know, probably earning maybe above average income, I would have thought, good for me. What did you? What made you think? Okay, let's look at some ways to get into business because you've done some
Businesses. It's an interesting question. You're right. I mean, things were working out quite well in the sales business. I was doing very nicely. But then there was a political campaign in 1974, and I got involved in running a campaign because I'd had some experience, and the guy that was looking for a campaign manager heard that I had, and he asked me if I would do it, and I did. And you know, as many people wiser than I said, about 80% of life is just showing up. And if you know, very little will happen if I don't get out of my basement. So I got to get out of the basement and show up, and you meet people, and one thing leads to another. And that's exactly what happened. In this political campaign, I met a guy named Tom Culligan, and Tom was in the shopping center business, and I was in the selling construction equipment, and we liked each other, and we decided we'd go into business for ourselves. Now, neither of us had any idea what business, but we just decided we'd be in business. We had no money. We only had about $1,000, but we said, let's go into business. And we talked to folks, and before long, we found a guy that had invented a cheap, simple coin sorter, a plastic slide that you can throw your change in the top, and it would come down by gravity and sort itself out. And he said you could have the rights to sell them in Canada. And he was selling them in the States. And it turned out the market for coin sorters, you're not going to believe this, but the market for coin sorters turned out to be Catholic churches, of all things. And we got a list of every Catholic church, and before long we were selling coin sorters by mail order. It was perfect for a guy with $1,000. And I told you that Tom had been in the shopping center business, and one day he got a call from a former colleague, Tom, Bill Seeley, and said, Tom, he said, when you were leasing space in Burlington Mall, you leased a space to a guy that opened a coffee store. Would you go and see if they'd like to open one at Scarborough Town Center? So Tom went over and he said, Scarborough Town Center is one of the finest shopping centers in the land, best dollar per square foot in the GTA. Do you want to have a store in Scarborough Town Center? And the guy said, geez, we just had a baby. It's a long way apart. The traffic is bad, and business isn't very good. So Tom came back to the little house we shared and said, Frank, Scarborough Town Center is one of the finest shopping centers in the land, best dollars per square foot in the GTA. Do you want it? Let's go in the coffee business. So with all that research done, we went in the coffee business. It was a disaster, Tom. It was a complete disaster. But we were young and foolish and didn't know any better, so we opened two more stores. And we lost money.
See if you could duplicate your disaster.
Yeah, my God, it was horrible. So hope, vision, action. You know, I talked about hope, vision, action, and we had a lot of hope, and we had a lot of vision, and we took some action, and we had to figure out what to do, and we were losing money hand over fist. And you see, back in 1975, all coffee stores in the world, or all in North America anyway, were the same. They were just little elite business selling coffee beans to people who wanted to make their own blend and take it home and drink their coffee at home. The biggest, the coffee outside of the house was disastrous. It was horrible stuff. In fact, coffee consumption outside of the home was declining at 14% a year. It was a complete disaster. Now, we didn't know any of this, of course. We were just naive. So we had this little coffee store, and we had these beans, and it was a disaster, and it wasn't going well. And we're standing outside of Baskin Robbins having an ice cream, looking across our store, and we came up with three ideas, one of which was going to create a billion-dollar industry. And
wow.
The first idea was, why don't we put a coffee maker on the counter and brew some coffee so people will taste it and they'll buy more beans? The second idea was better, let's charge for the coffee. And the third idea was the best of all, and this really did create a billion-dollar industry. It's remarkable when you think about it, when you analyze it. But we didn't know it, of course. We just decided we were going to charge more for our coffee than anybody else in the mall so people would know they had a good cup of coffee. It worked like a charm. It worked like a charm. And I'm sure there's people in your audience that have spent $2, $3, or $4, or $5 a cup of coffee in the last week, and that wasn't about coffee. That wasn't about buying themselves a cup of coffee. That was about buying themselves a treat. It changed the market. The relationship between the coffee and the customer changed completely when we premium priced it. It became a treat, not a coffee. And that was huge. Now, of course, we delivered value, and the value was better coffee and, you know, choice of strength and choice of country and those kinds of things. But nonetheless, it was about buying themselves a treat. And you see people lined up at Starbucks and Second Cup and Timothy's and all of the others, and they're all buying themselves a little treat, a little oasis in life where they can have a treat. And that's what happened. It was 9 years after we put our first cup of coffee in a second cup store that Starbucks put a cup of coffee in their store. It was a huge differential. It was unbelievable. And today, coffee consumption is still growing at 7% a year, when in 1975 it was declining at 14% a year. So it had been a remarkable run. Now, I sold my business in 1985 to Tom, and then Tom subsequently sold it. But that was a great run, had a great time, and
wow.
We learned a lot. We learned how to overcome adversity. I mean, there were all kinds of disasters through all of that. But in the end, hope, vision, action got us through it all.
Wow, and it sounds like, man, you seem to follow Napoleon Hill's formula, because the number two principle is the Mastermind Alliance. And you and Tom seem to have the Mastermind Alliance. Now, neither one of you had all the answers to anything. Like, you were blind leading the blind, it sounds like, half the time. But at least you sound like you encouraged each other. You came up with creative ideas. You took action. Hill talks about perfect harmony, which doesn't always mean agreeing, but it means that once you're behind something, you just go all out. And so it sounds like you just lucked into an amazing Mastermind Alliance as well.
Yeah, that you're exactly right, Tom. It was exactly that, and every business I've had since then has had to have partners or mastermind, as you said. I just find that I don't know the answers, and I also need to have a sounding board. I've got a business today that is probably the biggest thing that I've ever done, and I've got a partner, well, two partners, but one with I work every day. And it's just, we've just got a great relationship, and we just walk back and forth between our offices and got new ideas and new thoughts and new focus and always trying to refine the vision and the mission of the company, and it's tremendous. It's the way to go for me.
Wow. And I remember another business that people don't actually always tie to you is ProShed Security. I remember when it came out, I thought, wow, whoever those guys are, that's brilliant. And yet, if you look at it now, probably there's not a lot of paper use, but I guess people probably still need to shred paper. So tell me about ProShed Security, because I remember
you got it
at
backwards.
The time. Oh, yeah?
Tom, you've got it backwards. There's more paper today than there ever was.
Oh.
I can remember when we were trying, oh, my God, I can remember when we were trying to raise money and people were saying, oh, goodness, there won't be any paper. It's going paperless. We're consuming at least a dozen times more paper today than we were in 1985 when we started it. Well, because you can print so easily. We had companies that used us. They printed stuff out. Remember the old track printers from computers? They would print out miles of that stuff. Nobody ever saw it, of course, and they'd have to shred it all because it's all in plain English. There's no codes. When I used to do stuff by hand, nobody could read it. But when you've got a computer, everybody could read it, so that you shred it. The amount of paper is doubling every 3 years. It is enormous volumes of paper. So shredding business is still a very, very big business. Sold that in 2002, I think.
Can you explain to me the process of how you, like, we're two guys sitting around and somebody says, you know, somebody's going to need a shredder for all this paper. Is this an industry you invented? Because
it's an industry we invented. Actually, a guy named Scott Smith had the idea, and he came to me for some money, and we chatted, and my brother and I looked at it and thought we might be able to do it. Now, the interesting thing that I have discovered about launching new industries or new businesses, and I've had the great fortune of starting complete industries. Like, the Second Cup was the first guy to put coffee by the cup in a store, in a gourmet coffee store, and you can see that now as a multi-billion-dollar industry. The shredding business was the same. It was a brand new. Nobody had ever done it. Nobody had ever put a shredder on a truck before we did. And once you put a shredder on the truck, now it's a global business. But when we started it, what you do is you're launching a new value proposition into industry, into the world. Nobody's ever seen it before.
Right.
And therefore, there is no defined market. You don't know who your market's going to be when you launch a new value proposition.
Right.
So you have to find it. So we put a shredder on a truck, and it was the wrong shredder on the wrong truck, and it was a disaster. But we marketed it to people who were sensitive about governance, and there were very few companies in those days who had any concern about privacy.
Mm. Okay.
But Bell Canada had a huge concern about it, and they were our first customer. And wow. they loved the fact that they could see the documents to be shredded. You see, before we put a shredder on a truck, you had to send it someplace to be shredded. So you never knew about the security of the product. You, and
right.
there were all kinds of stories of people who said they shredded it and didn't. And it went to a garbage truck, and it was found on the side of the
right.
road.
Right, I remember
off.
Those, yeah.
Absolutely, bank documents falling off trucks and all that sort of stuff. So it was a brand problem. If Bank of Montreal lost records, I mean it affected their brand. You can't do that. So,
oh, yeah.
And until we showed up, nobody had a solution. So we were a solution, and what happened, of course, is the market grew exponentially. People who had never even thought of shredding would see our trucks roaring around doing.
Yeah.
Things. My God, we ought to be doing that. And before long, we grew the business into a very large business in Canada and U.S., and we started in France by the time I'd sold it.
Wow, and that's the thing, the truck. I saw the truck one day. I was like, oh, my yeah. God, who's thought of
Absolutely.
That? That's an amazing idea. And
yeah,
so the truck
people,
acted as
people.
An advertising.
Absolutely, and they were noisy, so they drew attention.
Now, it sounds
oh,
like
it was a
there's
great.
A... There's one similar point to your different businesses, is they were all a disaster when you started.
Yeah, they
and
were,
so
yeah,
I was
because it's a little like reading a book about swimming. Doesn't do you much good until you get in the pool.
Reading a book about swimming. It's not going to help you a lot. Put your arm like
not
this and like that. Exactly.
Yeah.
And but once you're homeless, do business challenges seem like, whatever, I still have a roof over my head and I haven't missed a meal today? Or is it
well,
like
that's right.
just a different strange, a different setting for a different kind of adversity?
Well, it is, but you know, I still run into lots of adversities, and there's some of them look like serious crises. I've got family today, and I have a responsibility to my family, so it can't be taking the risks that I used to be able to take. But
right.
nonetheless, it's important to know what my talent and skill is to find. I mean, I love big ideas. I like big ideas. Not idea. I don't want to open another gas station or another motel or another. You know, I'm not interested in any of that. The things that I like to do are things that are going to change the world, things that
nice.
Are going to change the way things are happening. I like big ideas, and that's both a curse and a blessing, because lots of times when you start with big ideas, they fail, and they
yes.
fail spectacularly. But on the other hand, when they're successful, they do change the world. And
right.
that's what I like to do. I like to do that in the not-for-profit sector. I like to do it in the business sector. I like to do it where it's never been done before. That's what I like to do.
Nice. You know, you talked in the non-profit, and this is how kind of I measure my life, my years. When I get to the end of a year, I look, how much time, money, and energy did I give away? And so I love this humanitarian one. And the one I really like, Canadian Landmine Foundation, a fellow certified Napoleon Hill instructor, a friend of mine from New York, Tim Chim. He escaped from Cambodia after the Vietnam War. He was in a lineup to be shot. He jumped out of the lineup, people shooting at him. He escaped through a jungle, and then he got to these mountains. He had to climb numerous mountains to get to Thailand. And he said, Tom, I had to climb the highest mountains because there wouldn't be landmines on those ones. If I just climbed
sure,
the easiest
yeah.
ones, there would be landmines on all the easy ones. And so until then, I had never come face-to-face personally. This is a friend where I heard about landmines and you know, the impact they have and how many there are in times of war. How did you get onto this Canadian Landmine Foundation? Because that is an amazing charity, but it's not one that comes to people's minds all the time.
Well, the Canadian Landmine Foundation started by a request from one of the, I think, foremost Canadians, certainly the finest Canadian foreign minister we've had since perhaps Pearson or maybe even before that, but Lloyd Axworthy was the, in my mind, one of the finest, and he had he was a Napoleon Hill example for sure, because he had great vision and he had a great group of people around him that supported him and focused, and he created the International Criminal Court that we now see war crimes being tried. He created the landmine treaty. He created the rights of the child. These are all creations here on Sussex Avenue in his mind, but he then fortunately had the support of great Prime Minister John Cruickshank. But as a result of that, he was able to really make an impact on the world, a Canadian impact on the world that all Canadians ought to be very, very proud of. And one of the big issues was landmines, where he described to me one day over lunch that there were about 100 million landmines in the ground, mostly in Asia, some in quite a bit in Africa, some in Europe. And the problem, of course, with landmines is that when the belligerents leave the field, the landmines stay. And who gets hurt,
right,
for the most part is women and children for the most part. And they put landmines in terrible places. They put them in around wells where when people go for water, or at bridge crossings where people are forced to come across, or in schoolyards. I mean, they put them everywhere. They're really a weapon of terror because they're very, very cheap. And because they're so cheap, they just put them in the ground whole as bolus. So you've got them everywhere in Asia and Africa, and it's a pretty horrible mess. And it turned out that about every 22 minutes somebody was stepping on a landmine. So it was devastating to these folks. And in the late 80s, early 90s, there was a group of NGOs, Red Cross, Red Crescent, Oxfam, some of the big ones, came together to create a treaty to ban landmines. Well, Tom, to do a treaty, it usually took on history-wise, it took about 13 to 18 years to get a treaty passed at the UN. It took a very long time because the process was arduous. People would get together once a year, discuss the issue, draft a treaty. Treaties would flow back and forth between the stakeholders, and then another meeting be held a year later, and on and on and on. Well, the fourth such meeting was held here in Ottawa. When Mr. Axworthy got up at the end of the meeting and thanked everybody for coming and said, "You can't do this. We can't go on for another 15 years. We must get this done." And he made the following challenge. He said, "Look, we'll dedicate our staff in Canada to travel and talk to every stakeholder during the next year, and we will draft a treaty at the end of 1 year, and then 2 months later I'm asking everybody to come back here to Canada to sign a treaty." And he went on to say that if no other country in the world signs the treaty, Canada will sign the treaty 14 months from here. And they said it couldn't be done. Well, 14 months later, 122 countries did sign the treaty, and they banned the use, production, and stockpiling of landmines. U.S. did not sign, by the way. And that was a story between Jean Chrétien and Bill Clinton, and the Pentagon was opposed because of North and South Korea. And they wanted a moratorium on that section, and they would sign the treaty. They needed 5 years to create a new weapon to keep the two parties apart. And unfortunately, the NGO community turned that down. So the U.S. did not sign, but I hasten to add that they acted as if they did sign. They were the foremost supporter, other than Canada, per capita on helping get rid of landmines, and they acted as if they signed it. They stopped producing them and so on. Well, Mr. Axley asked me if I would create a foundation to keep Canadians interested in the issue. They needed to keep political feet to the fire on this issue, and the only way to do that is to keep civil society interested. If Canadians are interested, their politicians will be interested. If they aren't interested, the Canadian politicians will move on to other subjects, and that's just normal.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
I agreed that I would. And so that's how I created the Canadian Landmine Foundation.
Wow. And amazing story, and as I had mentioned before, when I found out about this and looking at it, it's like, wow, big problem. As you said, when the war is over, people go back, the countries or whatever go back, they don't come back and take them out. They're there forever. You could walk on a landmine 10 years later, you're still going to get blown up, and it could be a kid,
absolutely,
a child, and, you know, anybody. It's not discriminate about who it blows up on. And so, man, you are unique, man. You created the shredding industry. You created the actual paying a lot of money for coffee industry. And now the Landmine Foundation, not a lot of people I've heard of that are involved with that, but an amazing foundation. Another one I love, Night of a Thousand Dinners. That's pretty cool. It's an internet-driven charity, isn't it?
Well,
explain it, because it sounds cool.
Yeah, it's so simple. When we were trying to decide how we would keep people interested in the landmine issue, we tried to come up with an idea that would be simple, easy to execute, and people could grasp the idea in an easy, simple way, because we can't reach everybody, but the Internet can. So we began talking about it on the way to New York, actually. I was flying down to speak at the UN with the Ambassador for Landmines, and we began to talk about how we might do this. And we came up with the idea that we would have a very simple program where we would ask our friends and neighbors to have their friends and neighbors in for dinner on a Friday night, just as they would any other Friday night where people would gather and have dinner. And we would do it on one night a year all across Canada. And we thought, in the first year if we could do it in, say, Vancouver, Calgary, Toronto, Montreal, maybe New York, because we got a lot of Canadians in New York, and since we were going to the UN, we thought maybe we could talk to some folks there. And we'd ask people to have at least everybody in. Everybody would have people in for dinner on a particular date, and they would either, they'd talk about landmines, and they would write a letter to their MP or the U.S. congressman and send a check, large or small. And that would start to engage people. And we said, if we could have in a couple of years or 3 years, maybe 1,000 dinners happening all over the world on the same night, that would have some import and some gravitas for the issue. Well, the next morning over breakfast, just before I got up to speak, Dan Livermore looked at me and said, let's try for 1,000 dinners this year. So with an hour later, I got up at the UN and announced Night of 1,000 Dinners. And out of that came what is now known as Night of 1,000 Dinners, and it happens still every year on December 8th. And the first year, Madeleine Albright, who was Secretary of State at the time in the U.S., said she would have the first dinner, and she would have it 1 month before the formal dinner, so she could announce the dinners. And she had it at the State Department. And Tom, she asked everybody in the world that the U.S. was involved with to come to the State Department and have a dinner so they could announce Night of 1,000 Dinners. Or about 2,000 people showed up for dinner at the State Department. Madeleine was there. She hosted the dinner, and she announced Night of 1,000 Dinners. And I want to tell you that Colin Powell had the next two. So they had lots of dinners, and they told the world about it. And so everybody that was interested in the issue knew about Night of 1,000 Dinners. And I want to say one other thing. Rotary International was probably, or Rotary Clubs and Rotary International were very, very supportive of this. Many, many, many clubs were involved. And they were involved, and they had dinners, and they would invite non-Rotary members and to their homes, and they would have dinners, and it allowed them to expose Rotary to new people, but by the same token showed people what Rotary was doing. And it was a great experience. I love what Rotary did to help us on this. And in fact, I met a Rotarian in Mozambique. He ran the Coca-Cola franchise, and he had heard about Night of 1,000 Dinners. And we were down there talking about landmines. And he said, "Here's what I do, Frank." He said, "I give every employee who wishes it, it's by their choice, but if they wish, they can have 1 week off, fully paid, as long as they do something that involves the community and helps grow this great country of theirs." And he said their only responsibility is to report back to all the other employees what they did with their week off. And it was the most remarkable. I met a bunch of their employees working in the landmine fields, supporting the landmine removal folks, bringing them water and food and so on, so that they could continue their job, so they could rebuild their country. It was remarkable. Rotarians are a remarkable group.
I love it. One of my goals this year is to join a Rotary Club and become an active member. And I spoke at a Rotary meeting a few weeks ago. And you are right. You can go in any city, town, small town, even if they got 8 people, they're going to have a Rotary sign outside the town when you go in.
Absolutely.
Because in every city that they're in, big or small, they make an impact. They're people who have your third part of your hope, vision, action. They are people of action. They're out raising money, giving money, helping people, all for the benefit of others and not really at all for their own personal gain. And so amazing organizations and amazing how you've come across some of these great people in your life that have helped you so much. And that Night of 1,000 Dinners, what an amazing idea. And so did you say you're 68 now?
Yeah, 68 years old.
You're not thinking of retiring. It sounds like you're just, your brain's firing on all kinds of ideas. And so how do you allocate your time with all the different ideas for the balance of the next 40 years?
Well, I was on the board of a cemetery company, Tom. It was a very big cemetery. We had a lot of cemeteries, so we were very interested in demographics because we want to know when we're going to get you,
right.
Because we do get everybody. It just takes a while sometimes,
yeah.
And of course it impacts on land use because as we use up land, of course we have to have new cemeteries and so on. And this is a very old cemetery, been around since 1826, so it's been around for a very long time. And we have a lot of cemeteries. We have a lot of land. And, in fact, we have land that we haven't even turned into cemeteries yet that are still farmers' fields because we bought them years ago. And the reason we bought them years ago is it used to be that 75% of people who died were buried. You know, pretty simple. But now it's about 75% are cremated. So it's changed everything, changed land use dramatically, as you can imagine.
So,
you know, when you talk about what are you going to do for the next 40 years, well, a few years ago, we had the demographers in talking about life expectancy because that impacts on cemeteries, of course. And they claim that a child born in 2030, now this is their models, it's not a guarantee, of course, but their models show a child born in 2030 will live to 125. Well, if you're going to live to 125, you better not be thinking about retiring at 65. A, you probably can't afford it, and B, you'd be bored to death. So what the hell are you going to do with your life after 65? Well, I've never had that problem. I always like to keep working. I like big ideas, as I said, and we're building 1,100 houses in Brazil, and we're building a new high-tech digital service company with here in Canada, and we're doing a lot of things. So I find that I always have to find good people. I've got a good guy running my business in Brazil, and I got a good guy running my business in Canada, and I just talk to them and try to keep it focused. And I got a pretty good Rolodex, so I can get in to see just about anybody. So if they need help, I can find my way through most of the fog, and get in to see some folks. So whether it be raising money or contacts for business or those kinds of things, I can, you know, my Rolodex, as I say, is pretty good.
Yes,
so I can usually see somebody. So that's my great use for the company at these times. So I don't work that hard. In fact, you know, I don't dig many ditches anymore. But I get in there and I show up at the office every day. And I but by the same token, I've got family and I want to spend time with them. And I have other outside interests that I like to spend some time with. So that's how I balance it all.
Yes, nice. And with definiteness of purpose, when you're passionate and you have a purpose, who wants to retire from that? I have told people I have no plan ever to retire. I want to be passionately involved in life until one of those pieces of land captures me that you were on the board of. But yeah, retirement, okay, maybe retire from work, but don't retire from life or contribution or serving. And if you love what you do, why would you even want to retire from work?
I think that's right. You know, and I remember reading somewhere, well, two stories, actually. That one is the Colonel Saunders, as I understand it, started Kentucky Fried Chicken when he was 62. So, you know, given inflation, 68 is not a bad time to start a business. It's pretty good, I think. So there's lots of time to grow a business and do some things as long as you stay healthy and do a little exercise, eat properly. You probably, you know, life expectancy, no guarantee, of course, but life expectancy for me is somewhere in the 90s. Well I'm not going to retire. I've got 20 years. Well, how much golf can you play? So that doesn't seem to me like a very attractive thing at all. But, you know, I just want to tell you one other story about hope, vision, action, about our psychology, about focus, about subconscious focus. And I don't recall any of this, but my mother reported this to me before I died. Apparently, when I was 13, I read an autobiography of a guy named William Zeckendorf. And the book opens with him going bankrupt for $300 million. Now, I know time is short, so I won't tell you a big story, but it told him about him going bankrupt for $300 million. Now, I was 13 years of age at the time. Apparently, when I put the book down, I turned to my mother and said, when I'm 35, now I didn't know what 35 was when I was 13, I'll have $1 million. Now, I didn't know what $1 million was when I was 13 either, but I said, when I'm 35, I'll have $1 million. The power of the subconscious. I was 34, I was broke. At 35, I had $1 million. And I didn't even remember saying it.
But your mom remembered you saying it to remind you, so wow.
Yeah,
you,
absolutely.
Something you put in your head at that young an age, your brain was like,
that's right.
Okay, sounds like he's pretty powerfully convinced about this. We better go do it.
I better go and do it. And, you know, you asked earlier how you sort of come together with Mastermind and all that. Of course you do. But, you know, at some point, you know, if you're not an entrepreneur, you're not going to be one. I don't think you can make one, but I do think if you have that in you, you can be one, and you can be a better one if you use the tools that are available, and you know more about those than anything. You are the best coach in the world about all that, because you give people tools that allow them to become themselves. But you can't make an entrepreneur, I don't think. You can only encourage one.
Exactly, and everyone's purpose could be different because
there's people
that serve and help healthcare and all these, and you know they're passionate about it. It's their purpose, and so find whatever your purpose is and just never retire from it. You may have to do it differently
Absolutely.
As you go along, but never retire from it because it's a passion, and if it serves other people, stopping it is no benefit to you and is depriving people of the service you would render. And
to take it to a higher plane, it's a disappointment to God. I mean, I think God
yes.
gave us these values
yes.
and these talents and these abilities, and it's our job to use them. And if we don't use them, then I think it's disrespectful.
It is, and it's our job to earn as much as... Hey, we live in North America. 4 out of 10 people in the world live on less than $2 a day, so it's our duty to earn as much as we can so that we can give as much as we can to those people or help people. And so, yeah, if not, why does God will be disappointed? Be like, I gave you so much talent. One thing, just final, we'll close with this. I love the action part because a lot of what I do, and you know, I fail a lot of times, but my philosophy seems to be the ready, fire, aim. Just take action. You know, take action, and eventually you'll find what doesn't work, what does work. A little bit of trial and error, try and make that less each time. But I love the action part. Just take action. You're going to learn. You may learn the hard way.
Get in the pool.
Stop
reading the book.
Stop reading. Yeah, don't read the book about swimming. Get out there.
Yeah,
jump in the water.
Get in the pool.
And so hope, of course, if you have no hope, the Bible's pretty clear about that. People without hope mm-hmm. or vision perish. And so when you have the hope and then you have the vision, which is vision is another word for purpose. What's your purpose? What's God's purpose for you? And then action. Don't just sit around telling people, oh, this is my vision. Get out there and show them what your vision is. Move. Do something. Even if you screw up, you're going to learn something. And if you screw up enough times, eventually you'll have something just, you know, home run just makes you famous, and you're like, wow, nobody remembers those 92 other things I failed at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And there's no shame in failure. There may be disappointment, but there's no shame in it. It's disappointing. Of course it's disappointing. And you'd be a fool if you weren't disappointed, because if you weren't disappointed, you probably wouldn't learn anything. No. Failure is fine. Not happy, but it is fine. I mean,
right.
I failed so many times, my goodness. But, you know, out of that comes, an ability to share, to spend some time with Tom too tall, and talk to his audience about some of the mistakes I made. And I'm happy to do that. It's wonderful to be able to do that because it has some value to others when you're able to share it.
Exactly. And then whatever comes up against you in life after that, you're like, is that the best you can throw against me? Like, come on, this is not going to get me down. And so I think the more you fail, the better you get at, like, understanding that, hey, the world didn't end, and my friends still like me, and my wife's still married to me, and my kids haven't abandoned me. And so let's get up tomorrow and see what I can do, what damage I can do tomorrow.
Exactly. It's all part of the process, and if we cherish our history, we can share it and give to others. I mean, these are really important, very, very important. Napoleon Hill figured that out a long time ago.
He did, and so it's basic principles, and so I love it so much, and I love your motto is, wow, did you come up with that on your own, the hope, vision, action, because that is... a three-step formula that is guaranteed to bring you from despair to at least doing something.
Absolutely.
As
I often say in my speeches, get out of the basement. It isn't going to work.
Yes,
you just got to get out and show up. You have to get out. You have to meet people, talk to people, share with people, and before long it'll take you in paths you never, ever dreamed of.
Amen. Thanks so much, Frank, for your time. This has been exciting. I don't interview a lot of Canadians, and so when I hear a great Canadian story like this, and then when I found out Pro Shred, I was like, wow, I was impressed before it was Second Cup. Now I'm like, he did Pro Shred too? This guy's like a genius. But actually, you sound like you just failed your way into a bunch of great successes.
Exactly.
Your family are still trying to figure it out. How did this guy do so well?
And the best is yet to come, Tom.
Yes, in the next 40 years, watch out.
Yep, exactly.
Thanks so much for your time today, Frank. Have yourself an amazing day, and thanks for sharing these great tips with our audience. I love it.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me on. It's been an honor.
Take care.
Bye-bye.